Thanks for listening to us here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations, you're more than welcome. Phone numbers are as follows. Anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Maybe even avid or voracious readers would not necessarily jump at the chance to read a novel that delves deeply into botany, but a novel involving botany written by Elizabeth Gilbert, well, that might be a different matter. Elizabeth Gilbert has many readers and many fans among those readers. She's best known for the memoir Eat, Pray, Love, which sold millions of copies in dozens of languages. The novel out at the beginning of last month is called The Signature of All Things. Elizabeth Gilbert is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff. I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk about the title, The Signature of All Things. What does that mean?
Well, The Signature of All Things is actually a theory that was posited by a mad German mystic cobbler guru in the 16th, you know, that's a stereotype, right?
Right.
In the 16th century, and he believed that God so loved mankind that the Lord had imprinted into the design of every plant on earth a clue as to the usage of that plant. So the simple example would be to say that walnuts look like human brains when you open them up, and they're really good for headaches. and he kind of went a little mad with this theory, but it was, I find that just the language of that sentence very beautiful, but also in my novel, which is a novel of 19th century botanical exploration, everybody in there is sort of doing the same thing. They're looking for the code and the clue and the taxonomy of plants.
It's like a combination of intelligent design, the Da Vinci Code, and was it National Treasure?
Yes, it is kind of exactly. They're all trying to break the code. I mean, they're seeking nothing less than the meaning of life, and they're trying to find it through the design of plant life.
All right, that explains the focus on botany then. You're known for meticulous research. You have a pretty good launch, I understand, though, into the subject of botany and plants.
Well, yeah, I grew up on a farm. My parents were Christmas tree farmers, which I know does not impress people very much in the piniest place in the world. I grew up in Connecticut, but it was a big deal for us in Connecticut to have a pine farm. And my mother was a master gardener, and I grew up, well, I could say, I mean, it's a terrible pun, but I have deep roots in the botanical world and have also become a really passionate gardener as an adult. And I knew that whatever I was going to write next was going to have to be about plants, but I had to kind of reach back in time and find the most exciting moment in plant history so that I could also write the action-adventure on the high seas novel that I wanted to write.
Well, what made it so exciting? Was it partly because of discoveries that led up? I mean, this is the same century in which Darwin did his work. I assume this is part of the whole process?
It is, yeah. And I was really fascinated in my research to discover that the questions of evolution had been existent quite long before Darwin, almost, well, you could certainly say 80 years before Darwin. People in science were already trying to figure out why species transmutated, why, you know, what was the meaning of these dinosaur fossils that they were discovering. You know, it was pretty clear that the oceans and continents were not where they had always been on the Earth, and so they were trying to pull this all together. But Darwin was the one who actually figured out the mechanism. But a number of people were circling around that question, including my lead character, Alma Whitaker.
Were you able to figure out about when the term evolution first came into use?
Oh, that's a really good point. But I don't know the exact first usage, but it was well in use 50 years before Darwin ever spoke about it. And that was a surprise to me because I had previously misunderstood the situation. I thought that Darwin invented and discovered evolution. In fact, you know, everybody was onto it. It's just that nobody figured out how it worked. Everybody knew that species were mutating and changing over time. But he was the only one who figured out what the mechanism was.
As you researched the attitudes, both the scientific ones and the ones in response to those, was there a very strong backlash about people suggesting that, gee, maybe there were hands at work here that really weren't hands and really weren't belonging to God?
You know, it was really interesting. I became much more sympathetic to the struggle that people feel when they are faced with the evidence of evolution. I've never been particularly sympathetic to that. I've always sort of come down on the side of scientific reason in that particular question, even though I consider myself a spiritual person. But I became very sympathetic to it because when you go back and read the firsthand accounts of that debate, even decades before Darwin, you can see that there's this terrible rift that was occurring in the collective soul of men of science, because up until that point in Western civilization, there really was no difference between being a man of science and a man of God. In fact, a lot of the great 18th and 19th century naturalists were ministers because, for one thing, they had the education and the leisure time to go looking for these questions. And for for the other thing, the natural world was where you found evidence of God's glory, right? That's how you celebrated God's glory. And the problem was that the evidence started to contradict the biblical story. And you can see people start to really fall apart over this. And that it was no joke, you know, what it did to their minds, to their souls, to their relationships with each other, where suddenly, for the first time in human history, you had to make a choice between your reason and your faith. And it injured people in really serious ways. And I feel like that division between reason and faith, you know, ended up kind of going through a really bad divorce in the 19th century, and we're still dealing with the consequences of that divorce today.
Sure, and some of the people who were ministers and naturalists at the same time probably had to, they were like the children of the divorce, trying to figure out which parent to stay with.
Well, in fact, I feel like we are all sort of the children of that divorce. I feel like those parents are still fighting over the kids, and it's been such an ugly divorce, they don't even go to the same parties together.
They don't have holidays together.
Yeah, exactly. They won't even stand in the same room next to each other. And I feel like it's left us in this kind of, I think it's a loss for humanity, because it's left us at this moment where we stand now, which we have a world full of scientists who have no divinity left in them, and we have a world full of the faithful who seem to have lost all their reason. And somehow we're going to have to work that out.
Alma Whitaker, the lead character in The Signature of All Things, is she based upon anybody you know?
She wasn't based on any one figure in particular, but I did an enormous amount of research on 18th and 19th century lady botanists. And there were quite a few of them, because botany was the only science into which women could even a little bit venture, because it was about plants and flowers. And out of those lives, I drew Alma.
Much more to talk about with Elizabeth Gilbert. She is the author of the book, The Signature of All Things. This is her latest novel. Elizabeth Gilbert, of course, also known for Eat, Pray, Love. We will talk much more with her and take your phone calls and emails here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Elizabeth and talk to you as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Elizabeth Gilbert. Yes, she wrote Eat, Pray, Love, but she's got a new novel out called The Signature of All Things. Her heroine, Alma Whitaker, is studying botany in the 19th century at a time of great societal and scientific and social upheaval. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the novel and the work of Elizabeth Gilbert. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Elizabeth, you were saying that botany was one of those areas that women actually could get into. Was it because the women could hang around flowers and that was
right? Well,
okay?
the world of plants and flowers has largely been a feminine domain for most of history, and so it seemed a natural extension. And I always like to say that women snuck into the field of botany through the garden gate, and once they were in there, they made tremendous contributions. So it wasn't difficult to find remarkable female botanists to go back and study, and I found they tended to have certain things in common. They tended to be either the wives, daughters, or siblings of famous men of science. They tended to be independently wealthy, and they tended to be either spinsters or childless. And I think out of that, I grew my own character, who is, of course, all of those things.
And so is Henry Whitaker, Alma's father. Is he also a botanist?
He is. He's actually more of a botanical entrepreneur, more than he is a strict scientist like she is. In my novel, he's born to a poor-born orchardman outside of Kew Gardens in London in 1760. And Henry is very ambitious and very ruthless, even as a child, and he becomes a plant thief from Kew Gardens, which was actually a very common crime back then when plants, especially the exotic varieties, were worth quite a bit of money. And plant thief, that was a hanging crime, but instead of being hung, he manages to talk his way out of it and gets himself put on board Captain Cook's final voyage as an assistant to one of the botanists, and that's where he learns and masters botany and also sort of begins to understand the world of colonial commerce, and he ends up making a fortune in the quinine trade.
Boy, I don't know which question to ask next, about Captain Cook and all the stuff he did for science around the world, or about the fact that you could be hanged for stealing plants from Kew Gardens.
I know. As a 14-year-old, you could be hanged for stealing plants from Kew Gardens. You know, these people were risking their lives to collect these plants, especially the ones that were very fashionable, the carnivorous swamp plants or the rare orchids from South America. They were worth a tremendous amount of money. And there was also a lot of scientific hoarding. Sir Joseph Banks, who was Captain Cook's botanist and who was, of course, the man who made Kew Gardens into the greatest botanical garden in Europe, he was known for not sharing specimens because he wanted all the glory and the dominance of the plant world to himself. And so sometimes plant thieves would be dispatched by rival botanical gardens to go and steal samples from Kew. It was all very action-adventure for the plant world.
You know, you must have been aware, certainly, about the attitudes toward women, particularly in women in science in the 19th century. But even so, were there things that made your jaw drop as you saw the way women were treated as they tried to enter science and similar hard professions?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I found sort of amazing and ridiculous is that because there were so many women who were botanizing, and because there really, at the beginning of the 19th century, did not really exist what we would call scientific professions. It was really the era of the great amateurs. And everybody was a dilettante, and everybody was wide-ranging in their passions, and we didn't really have academic distinctions yet. So women could publish, and they could discover things, and they could name plants. But then as the century went on and science became more professionalized, there was a movement within the botanical world to exclude women. And there was a guy who became the president of London College around 1825 who, in his inaugural speech, announced that we must now rescue botany from the ladies, that we have to return it to a serious pursuit for the serious minds of men. And the idea was that they felt by association that it didn't look like they were serious if they were doing the same thing women were doing. And then they really tried to kind of get them out of there after that.
How were things in a world of amateurs like you talk about? I mean, how were things brought to the forefront then? I mean, how would you know that there was a certain amount of respectability to a certain bit of work? Were there journals, as there are today, where you get published in Science, for example, and all of a sudden the rest of the world's going, hey, these guys know what they're talking about?
Yeah, there were journals. There was a lot of interpersonal correspondence. I think that's where a lot of it occurred. And there were, of course, the great scientific societies, the American Philosophical Society that Franklin had founded in Philadelphia, and then in London there was the Royal Society of Fellows, you know, and these were organizations where people would gather and share research, and then those organizations would publish journals. And there was certainly, I mean, I think one of the biggest efforts in science in the 19th century, especially in the natural sciences, was this effort to name the world, you know, to discover species and to identify species. And a lot of what you see in the correspondence are just big, sometimes very personal, sometimes very angry arguments about whether or not such and such a plant really is a brand new species that you get to name after yourself, or whether it's just a variety of an existing species, or whether this or that Scottish botanist already discovered it 10 years ago. You know, so there's a lot of, it's almost like patent disputes. and sometimes those disputes, you know, really were, they had real life financial consequences, especially in the pharmaceutical trade, where those plants could be very, very lucrative.
It sounds like at that time nobody was particularly concerned about some of the things that we think about today, like invasive species, like bringing things from Hawaii to England or something and trying to let them grow there.
Yeah, you kind of wince when you see that happening, right? You know, as somebody who is aware of what happens when you start to get really promiscuous with plant species, you can kind of be like, guys, no, don't do that. but they were also trying to do things. You know, Captain Cook and Banks were very interested, as we know from the story of the Mutiny of the Bounty, in bringing breadfruit to the New World, for instance, to create a nutritional foodstuff for slave workers, which ended up there, you know, being a not at all bad idea. It turned out to be a really.
Well, we should say that the feeding the slaves was the good idea.
Yeah, feeding the slaves. I mean, look, it was a horrible situation, but this was at least a possibility for something that they could not die, you know. And so, you know, there were certain pieces of it that they were figuring out in kind of interesting ways. But they were definitely, the bottom line was that they wanted to make a lot of money, and they were looking for the most lucrative plants, or the plants that would most help in colonial ventures, which means that to our eyes, it was all very unenlightened, and it was all very reckless.
Just sort of like cutting a broad swath through the landscape, and in some cases, literally.
Yeah, in some cases, quite literally, or importing, you know, animals from island to island or something, you know, coming to the French Polynesia and saying, you know, these people would be a lot better off if they had pigs. So we're going to put some pigs on this island, and then, you know, like 20 years later, they don't have a single indigenous bird, snake. You know, but that's what I also found interesting, though, is that Captain Cook took 3 voyages around the world. He returned to Tahiti 3 times over the course of about 12 years. And by the last voyage to Tahiti, you can see that he is now aware of what they have done, and he is full of regret. And I found that very surprising, too, because we don't think of these people as being very contemplative in that manner, you know, this, especially the white colonial British. But he had such regard for Tahitian culture and for Tahitian customs and even for Tahitian beauty. And when he returned 12 years after his first trip and saw that the population had been literally decimated, you know, only 1/10 of the population still remained, he knew that they had done that. You know, he knew that they had brought those diseases. He knew he could see the effects of venereal disease on the population. He could see the effects of smallpox, and he had a great sadness about it.
Elizabeth Gilbert is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her new novel is called The Signature of All Things, a novel of botany and women trying to advance in the science and a bunch of other stuff. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Elizabeth. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. As you go through The Signature of All Things, there's a voice, the narration is, I don't know, almost Dickens-like or something, and it's a bit of a 19th century quality to it. First of all, how much of other people's work did you read to get into that voice, and how hard was it to maintain once you'd started?
Well, I did 3 years of research for the book, which was not just scientific research, but also returning and reading all the great 19th century novels. So I read Dickens, obviously, you can see that in there, and you can also see strains of George Eliot, I think. There's sort of middle Marchian qualities in there, I hope. I was trying to get them in there. I also read an enormous amount of letters and diaries, but mostly letters, because that's where you can really hear people's natural speaking voices, and that's what helped me try to get the dialogue as authentic as possible. But I've always been a great reader of 19th century literature, and what I love about it is the same thing we all love about it, is that great, confident, self-assured narrator, the very reliable narrator, the narrator who says to you from the first page, take my hand, I've got this, I know exactly what I'm doing, come with me, it's all under control, which is something that we sort of dissembled a bit in contemporary literature. And I wanted to try to exude that sense of confidence for my readers so that they could just relax into the story and be carried along with it.
You mean more modern narrations tend to be along the lines of, well, I think this is what happened, but I'm not quite sure.
Don't trust me. Right. I'm just the witness. And I think, you know, I don't mind that, because I think that was a really important part of literary history, to try to, you know, sort of break that down and play with it. But, you know, I kind of prefer to not have a narrator who I'm afraid might drive me off a cliff.
That's a good thing.
I like to sort of shut my eyes and relax. I don't want to do all the work. There's a lovely line, I think it was Henry James, I'm trying to remember, but he was talking about a book he had read where he said the burden of responsibility on the reader in this book is at least half. and I feel like that's it might have been William James, I can't remember, but I feel like I like it when the writer takes responsibility for the book.
Were there false starts with trying to establish the voice that you used in The Signature of All Things? I mean, did you know, get in like 10-15 pages and go, yeah, this isn't working, let me try this a different way?
You know, not really. I think it's because I over-prepared. I was really intimidated about what I was taking on, and I was afraid of the voice most of all, and that's why I didn't even begin writing for 3 years. And a lot of the notes that I had taken during those 3 years were sort of, you could almost say they were like training. You know, I would practice a little scene or a little piece of it, so that when it came time to sit down and write the whole thing, I felt like I was already there. I had already kind of learned that language, and I was surprised at how comfortable I did feel with it once I began.
So 3 years of research before you really started writing, and I read an account not long ago by a man who writes articles for The New Yorker and other publications, and he was writing in The New Yorker about his process.
Uh-huh.
And all the cards he took and way he'd arrange them on bulletin boards and things. I can just imagine it must have looked like one of those murder walls on the TV crime shows when you're putting your materials together.
Yeah, it is. I write on index cards also, and it's a method that I learned in fourth grade from my Western Civilization social studies teacher, and I've learned it and used it ever since. I find that it's very satisfyingly tactile to sit there as you're reading a book and to take notes on index cards and then be able to file those cards by subject. So I had ended up with about 5 shoe boxes filled with index cards that were very tidily organized by subject matter, like, you know, missionary life in Tahiti, orchids, 19th century erotica, women's dress, you know, like just sort of whatever you would need, various characters' names, and then I could kind of pull out of that, and then it kind of feels like painting by numbers at that point once you get those all in order.
In the process, though, of getting all the details about the 19th century and things that happened and the kinds of people who lived at that time, do you still have to cut some corners in order to make this something that will be appreciated by an audience reading it in 2013?
Yeah, and I think one of the tricks I figured out was that I wasn't trying to write a book that felt as though it had been written in the 19th century, although I don't mind if you get a sort of glimpse of that feeling. What I feel about The Signature of All Things is that it is very much a contemporary novel written about the past, written from a contemporary viewpoint. So my omniscient narrator is looking back on the entire scope of the past. And in that way, I had a lot more liberty than if I were trying to pretend that I was George Eliot writing a book. I could really kind of get the perspective of everything that we've learned since then. And I could also write much more frankly about issues of sexuality, you know, things that older writers were not able to touch upon, I could write about very directly.
So Alma Whitaker herself, I mean, was she a bit of a stretch? I mean, were there women who were a lot like her in the 19th century that you found, or is she a bit more like one of us?
No, she's quite like one of them. That's kind of the amazing thing. And I'll tell you, when I initially set out to write this, my intention was to try to tell the story of a woman of towering intellect and great scientific gifts whose work is not regarded or taken seriously or published because she's a woman. That was initially my plan. But that storyline just didn't hold up when I went back and started examining the lives of these 18th and 19th century female botanists, some of whom had tremendous reputations and many of whom had done really bold and extensive traveling, often alone. I reiterate, like, most of them were heiresses, most of them were, you know, had relations in the scientific world, most of them were childless, so they were able to do that kind of thing. But some of the great lady Victorian travelers and scientists were really pretty remarkable. And when you read their journals about their voyages from Brazil to Madagascar, and you hear their opinions and you see the letters that they're writing to male colleagues and the way that they're scolding them on how they've gotten their taxonomy incorrect, all of a sudden they take on so much power that it just felt it would be a disgrace to their memory to tell the story of women who were being excluded when those women had quite forcefully pushed themselves forward.
You talked about how much of the reading you did of works in the 19th century, and apparently reading has just always been a part of your life. Did you grow up without television completely? Is that what I understand?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, my parents were funny like that. They didn't want that around us, and not only that, I grew up a little bit isolated because we lived on a family farm where we didn't have any neighbors our age in the neighborhood. And so it was really just my sister and myself, and we were kind of held responsible for our own entertainment, you know. My parents didn't consider it, in a very Calvinist way that almost parents had as well, they didn't consider it their job to entertain their children. We also had a lot of chores, but we discovered very early on, both my sister and me, and we both turned out to be writers, that when we had our heads in our books, that was the only time that my parents wouldn't take us away from whatever we were doing and put us to work and give us chores, because they had such high regard for reading. So we really kind of discovered that it was a refuge and a way to get out of moving the woodpile, you know. And so I think that was a great trick that my parents had to turn us into readers. And it wasn't long before we both wanted to be more than readers. We wanted to be writers.
So has your sister gone on to write as well?
She is, yeah. She's a very successful young adult novelist. She writes under the name Catherine Gilbert Murdoch, and she's written, I think, her 6th book just came out this year.
Just out of curiosity, where in Connecticut? Because I went to high school in Coventry.
Oh, really? I grew up in Litchfield.
Okay,
in
other side of the state, sure.
Yep.
We played you in basketball one year.
You beat us.
Oh, you remember too.
I can guarantee you that you beat us. I played basketball in high school, and one of our favorite moments in my history of sports was when our basketball coach said of my team to the newspaper, "Well, the girls' team this year, they're short but slow." We were not an athletic powerhouse by any means whatsoever.
No,
but we were pretty good in academics.
That's good. And the Connecticut Hills is certainly a great place to learn about things like plants and botany and stuff like that. So as Alma Whitaker goes through the book, I mean, how does she narrow her focus? What are the things that she's focusing more specifically on within botany?
Well, that was an interesting challenge for me because for half of Alma's life, I mean, really for the vast part of her life, she is a bit homebound. And in that regard, her life is very typical of most women of that time. She was her father's assistant. Her mother died at an early age. Her father was running a business. She was the only person he trusted. And she really couldn't leave the family estate, which was a quite opulent estate, but it was still, a golden cage in a way. And she had such a rapacious imagination and was such a great explorer of the natural world that after a very short period of youth, she had already discovered everything that was to be discovered on her family's estate. And so I have this moment where Alma kind of panics, wondering what in the world she's going to do with her mind and when she realizes that she's probably never going to leave home. And then I have her discover mosses. I needed her to find something that she could plausibly study that was so full of variety and so diverse that it could keep her occupied for an entire lifetime to try to study and chart out its progress, but would also be plentiful enough and nearby enough that she could study it from her own home, and that turned out to be mosses.
All right, we have much more to talk about just about mosses alone and the concept of moss as a resurrection engine. That'll be the next question when we come back from this break. We're talking to Elizabeth Gilbert about her book, The Signature of All Things. You can join our conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Elizabeth Gilbert and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Elizabeth Gilbert. Yes, that Elizabeth Gilbert of Eat, Pray, Love fame. She is out with a novel at the beginning of October. It is called The Signature of All Things, a story of botany and women's attempts to break into science and a lot more in 19th century. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, email jx@jeffnet.org. So Alma Whitaker is running out of things to look at because she's pretty much looked at all the plants on the family estate, and so she discovers mosses. You refer to moss as a resurrection engine. Why?
Well, it's kind of it has this remarkable ability to go dormant and then spring back to life with the slightest amount of water after sometimes 20, 30 years. It almost has eternal life. And it also has a sense of the eternal about it because it is the oldest land plant on Earth. And as I keep saying to people, you don't get to be the oldest land plant on Earth by being stupid and boring. It's a very intelligent and interesting and resilient plant system.
Interesting. Okay, so very resilient stuff. I want to talk a little more generally, though, about you and your life, and certainly since Eat, Pray, Love. First of all, was there a real sense of, I get to write a novel again after you're done with the two memoirs?
Yeah, a really big sense. I mean, people know me as a memoirist, and I understand why they would, but I did get my start in writing as a fiction writer. My first book was a short story collection, and then I wrote a novel, and then I took quite a long break from fiction because, frankly, I had some stuff to work out, and I needed to use my writing toward that purpose. When you're going through troubled times, you use whatever tools you have, and the writing was really helpful for me. But it's kind of it feels like a point of celebration in my life now that things are sort of going smoothly enough for me that I can invent dramas again rather than living them.
Yeah, you have to actually work a little harder to create these.
Yeah, believe me, I prefer it this way.
Yes, I can imagine. Obviously, when you're writing about yourself, you don't have to go through the 3 years of research you talked about doing for The Signature of All Things. So, I mean, how different was the process? I mean, was it just writing in anger at first and then going back and cleaning it up?
Wait, the memoir writing process?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's weird. Even there, I actually did do quite a bit of research. Like my book Committed, which was about my efforts to make peace with the institution of marriage, getting married for the second time after a sad divorce. I did probably 2 years of research on the history of matrimony there to build that book. I always feel more comfortable when I know the most that I can possibly know about something. And even with Eat, Pray, Love, all that time that I was traveling through Italy, I was writing and reading a great deal about the history of Italy and, you know, just trying to put things as much as possible into a historical context. So in that regard, it's kind of similar. The difference is, actually, what I think is fascinating, a friend of mine pointed out, who's also a writer, that whenever you write memoir, you're actually kind of writing fiction because you're so self-consciously portraying yourself. Whatever it is that you're choosing to reveal about yourself is very deliberate, and sometimes, you know, you may not even realize how much you're leaving out. And when you're writing fiction, you're always writing memoir, because you very accidentally, because you're so comfortable and relaxed with these so-called invented characters, you're sort of leaving your DNA and your fingerprints all over the page. And sometimes you end up revealing a great deal more about yourself through a novel than you might through a memoir.
I can imagine writing Eat, Pray, Love and Committed, there were things with like, oh, wait a minute, I can't put that in there. That's just a little too much information for the readers. Did you ever have the same feeling writing stuff about Alma, your fictional character?
Oh, that's interesting. I struggled because I knew that from the beginning that I wanted her to be a very carnal woman, that she was going to be passionate and lusty and sensual, even though she's not a beauty. As a female reader, I always object to the fact that the only women who get to be sexual in most books are great beauties, and that, of course, is not the reality of human sexuality. And so I wanted that to be a big part of her, and so she does some, for public radio usages, some sensual self-exploration in the novel, and I really stumbled over that because I didn't want to humiliate her and degrade her when I had come to love her so much as a character. But I got over it because it was such an essential part of who she was, and if I didn't have that in there established about her, then there are parts of the rest of the novel that would make no sense. But I did have to consult with a friend of mine who writes romance novels for advice on how to do period sensuality correctly.
Oh, just the euphemisms to use?
Yeah, exactly. And she gave me this great piece of advice. She said, look, we didn't invent sex in the 20th century, you know. and I thought, well, that's actually a really, really important point, because I think sometimes we think that it got invented in 1966, but it's apparently been around for quite a while.
Yeah, so I hear. let's take a call about your novel. Here's Justin in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of The Signature of All Things.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is awesome. I love the show.
Thanks.
I had a quick question going back to Captain Cook, his quest in Tunisia. And I was just curious if there was a log or, a record of the plants that he acquired. And I'm sure there are very many, but more importantly, you said he was trying to ultimately derive pharmaceuticals for lucrative reasons. And I was curious if there was a log as to what pharmaceuticals got derived from the plants.
Yeah, that's
And that's pretty much it. I'll take my answer off air.
All right.
If you made a lot of money from it.
Thank you, Justin.
Right, thanks, Justin.
That's a really great question, because that's, of course, what they were after. I mean, they were also after industrial plants, right? Like plants that could be used for dyes or for fabrics. The British were very interested in trying to get, you could call it cotton independence, in the same way that we speak of oil independence. And so they were looking for varietals of plants that could be would make them less dependent on the Indian cotton trade, for instance. And they were certainly trying to break the Dutch monopoly over the spice trade. So they were trying to find alternatives to nutmeg and cinnamon and those sorts of things, which were also considered to be medicinal plants at the time. But the main one that I got fascinated with. And to answer your question, yes, there are records, and they're all at Kew Gardens, and they're really open with their libraries there, and most of them are in the papers of Sir Joseph Banks, who was the chief botanist on the first voyage of Cook, and who came back with, I think, 5,000 varieties of plants that were unknown to science prior to that, and spent the rest of his life putting them into taxonomical order and studying them. But the plant that I found most interesting was quinine, which ends up being a main character in my novel, because The rest of Europe had been using quinine to treat malaria long before the British got around to it, because the British preferred to bleed their patients rather than give them potions. And Banks was kind of late in the game on that, and he was trying to play catch up and try to figure out where in some part of the British-owned world they could grow quinine so that they wouldn't have to deal with the Spanish, who had a monopoly on it in Peru. And he was trying to grow it in the lowlands of the Himalayas and in Indonesia, and he ultimately failed at it and ended up really holding back Britain from development in places where malaria was rampant, whereas the Dutch were able to get their hands on the secret recipe for quinine and ended up making an enormous amount of money in it.
It's really fascinating to think about all the parts of the world where there was so much upheaval because of the fact that people were looking for ways they could make money.
Yeah.
And so I bring the stuff from there to wherever they lived.
Yeah, exactly.
Or decided to colonize it because, no, they couldn't grow it there.
You guys, you know that Ben Franklin was trying to bring soybeans to America because he had read about tofu.
Really?
And it sounded to him like a really good thing to feed poor people with. And so he was trying to import soybeans from Asia and try to convince people in Philadelphia to grow it and to make tofu, which is really incredible. And he was like 200 years ahead of himself on that.
I would have thought of Ben Franklin as more of a meat and potatoes guy, but
he tried to be a vegetarian for a while and writes about it very, very wittily in his memoirs. I think he tried for a couple months and then he was like, oh, the hell with this. And you have to imagine in colonial Boston and Philadelphia that vegetarians probably didn't have that many options for but he gave it a shot.
Have you done enough research on Ben Franklin that you could do a book about him?
Oh, I don't think we could ever run out of books about Ben Franklin. I could happily read books about Ben Franklin for the rest of my life. I think he's my standard answer whenever people ask if you could, have dinner with one person from history, who it would be. But I wouldn't want to have dinner with him. I would want to take him to an Apple factory or something and show, take him to like the Boeing factory and show him how airplanes were made, like just blow his mind. But he was such a fascinating person and I was tempted to kind of put him as a character in my book, but I think he's too large a persona to stick into a novel without it feeling sort of jarring.
And Alma just would have missed him anyway, right? Because she was born in 1800.
Yeah. Her dad could have interacted with him, but I decided just leave him out of it.
So you yourself, Elizabeth Gilbert, though, I mean, you're one of the, called you one of the 100 most influential people in the world. How hard is it then to kind of step back from what other people say about you to be able to maintain your own sense of self in the midst of what you've been through in recent years?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to just have a really broad perspective on it all in order to say, the world is a terrible place full of horrible, horrible things that happen to people, and having a giant bestseller is not on the list of terrible things that happen to people. And to just make sure that I don't accidentally turn it into that, which would just be a pity and sort of silly, because I've been very fortunate to have been able to have that success. And that success has also financed, and will continue to finance the work that I want to do for the rest of my life, which is, to follow my curiosity wherever it might take me. And I'm really lucky, and I know that I'm really lucky as a writer, and especially as a female writer, to be able to do that, because that's not something that's afforded to everybody. And the bottom line, though, is that there's a weird kind of liberty that comes from people having decided exactly who you are. There's no point in trying to convince anybody to change their mind about you, because everyone is sort of ossified in their opinion of you, whether they adore you or can't stand you. And once that's all been established, then I feel like you're kind of free to go and be whatever you want. So I feel really, I feel very expansively free at this moment to just do whatever work I wish to do.
When people meet you, do they say, hey, you don't look like Julia Roberts?
Oh, people have been saying that to me my whole life.
It didn't take Eat, Pray, Love to get to that conclusion.
And believe me, they don't say that my husband looks like Javier Bardem either. But we can dream. We can dream, Jeff. We all got a big upgrade in that movie. We all got bounced from coach to first class big time.
What a funny way to put it, to first class. I imagine you must be thinking in terms of, particularly with the name that comes attached to the book, yours, that the signature of all things could potentially be picked up for a movie. I mean, did you have an actor in mind as you were writing?
I didn't have one in mind as I was writing, but I was about halfway through skipped a book when I started watching Game of Thrones. I don't know if you are a Game of Thrones watcher.
A little bit.
Then you may know Brienne of Tharn, the great female knight who's about 6'2" and can swing a broadsword as well as anybody you've ever seen. And she's a British actress, and I now cannot think of her name, unfortunately. What a bad fangirl I am. I'm sure you'll be getting a lot of emails about this. Anyway, she, as soon as I saw her come up on the screen, I was like, well, there's Alma, because my character is somebody who I think of as having been a tree among flowers at a moment in history where daintiness was particularly valued in femininity. She is not a dainty woman. She is large in every sense. She is physically large, and she is intellectually expansive, and she sort of towers over the women of her day. And the idea of having somebody with a very intelligent and soulful face who happens to be 6'2" with broad shoulders play that woman would make me so happy. I don't know if it would ever occur. I know how Hollywood works, so it's very possible that they would make it be Scarlett Johansson. But I would sort of rather that it be somebody of the Janet McTeer quality, like somebody who, you know, who looks like she can handle a broad axe.
Has there been a discussion of, I know it's early in the publication process, but has there been a discussion of the signature of all things and movie rights and all that stuff?
Yeah, it's being bandied around a little bit. And what I find interesting and what I'm sort of fascinated with is, like most of us these days, I'm coming around to the idea that some of the most interesting stuff that's happening is happening on television and not in the movies. And I kind of love the idea that's been spoken of making a miniseries out of it. Just the locations are so lush. It's a novel that takes place quite literally all over the world, over a century and a half, and I think it could be something really beautiful if it could spread out and take up all the space it needs.
I do have an internet in front of me. Gwendolyn Christie, is that the
actress? That's who we're talking about. well done.
So what is next? What is sitting in front of you now? Or are you just pushing the computer away and saying, not now?
I am, not now. And I do this kind of spooky, magical thinking thing. I've got an idea for a novel that's been in my head for the last 6 months. And, you know, every morning I wake up and I speak to it, and I reassure it that I am quite serious about getting to it. But if it will look around, it will notice that I am on book tour right now. And this is not the moment to be writing a book. But I will turn my attentions to it as soon as I can and stick with fiction for the time being, because it's been so joyful to be back in that world.
And we just actually missed you physically, it sounds like, because you're still in Portland?
Actually, I'm in Seattle.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm speaking tonight at Town Hall, sponsored by Elliott Bay.
All right, so a Northwest tour, but not quite our corner of the Northwest.
Not quite, I'm unfortunately sorry.
Well, and then holy cats, across the country to Portland, Maine, so the other Portland.
I know, I've had a rather crazy book tour, but it's also been exciting to come out and to reintroduce myself to people in a way that they may not be have been expecting. You know, even to my dearest and most beloved readers, a lot of them just don't know this side of me. So I feel like I've been kind of personally introducing myself again.
Elizabeth Gilbert needs no introduction for a lot of people. She's known for Eat, Pray, Love, her latest novel, The Signature of All Things, now out on the bookstands. And Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. That'll do it for the Jefferson Exchange today. Coming up Monday on the Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about a women's leadership conference coming to Ashland. We'll talk about the tax by mile policy coming into pilot progress in Oregon. And then we'll talk about the book, The New Soft War on Women. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren, our student assistant operating the controls today, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again Monday at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great weekend.